Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland. Some neighborhoods have payday lenders and check cashers on every block with no bank in sight. You might as well stash your cash in a cookie jar.
I taped the lid to it, and I made a hole on the top, and I was putting money into it.
We'll visit some unbanked parts of Los Angeles. A new Cash for Clunkers program lets you trade in that old Geo Prism for a sweet new ride. But
you still need to negotiate your lowest purchase price and then deduct the Cash for Clunkers. This doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a great deal.
We'll brave the lot to get the details. Plus, those credit card offers you used to write off as junk mail are now so scarce, some people feel lucky to get them.
I had a credit card solicitation, and it was like a Sally Field moment.
You like me right now. You like me.
And then she read the fine print. Those stories and more coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, this is Marketplace Money. Give yourselves a pat on the back. The national savings rate last month reached its highest level in 15 years. May not be great for the economy, but it's good for you, and you can take that to the bank. At least, most of you can. I'm Tess Vigeland. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
In the wake of the financial crisis, it is a challenge to figure out which banks to trust with your money. According to a new Gallup poll this week, our confidence in the banking system is pretty low, to say the least. A record low, 22%, in fact. Even when you know your deposits are insured by the government, who wants to put their money with an institution that might be on the brink of failure? But in a small segment of the population, issues with banks run far deeper than the events of the last year. For one thing, there are entire neighborhoods where it's just plain hard to find one.
I'm standing at the corner of Breed Street and Cesar Chavez Avenue in the Boyle Heights area of East Los Angeles. From this point, you could drive miles in each direction without seeing a bank branch. What you would see is plenty of what are called non-institutional lenders. To the east, for example, you've got Payday Advance, Jack's Market, where you can get money orders, Nick's Check Cashing and Big Ben's Check Cashing. To the west, you've got Ace Cash Express. In front of the one bank we could find, I met up with Matthew Fellows. He directs the Pew Safe Banking Opportunities Project.
So the ratio in Los Angeles as a whole is about 1-to-1. Here in this low-income neighborhood of Boyle Heights, it's actually more like 4-to-1. So 4 check cashers or payday lenders for every bank branch. In fact, this Bank of America branch is one of the only branches in this entire neighborhood.
Fellows is spearheading efforts in urban areas to bring the so-called unbanked population into the banking system and also to bring the banks to neighborhoods they haven't traditionally served. Here in Los Angeles, the program is called Bank on LA. The mayor's office says its goal is to add 10,000 people to the banking system and get them away from predatory lenders like check-cashing storefronts, payday loan outfits, and even liquor stores. 30-year-old Nancy Rodriguez is one of the success stories. Last week, Rodriguez opened an account at a Union Bank of California branch in South Central Los Angeles.
Okay, so just keep in mind that each time you want to withdraw cash, you have to come into the branch. Deposit, you also have to come in. Okay.
Could it be any branch from...
You could use any branch.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Nancy.
You're welcome. Thank you, Nancy.
The single mother of four was unemployed for about 2 years. She racked up hundreds of dollars worth of overdraft fees and ended up losing her account. After that, any money she received from welfare checks went straight to the kitchen counter.
You know what? I was using a cookie jar.
Yes, a cookie jar.
I taped the lid to it, and I made a hole on the top, and I was putting money into it.
She was also using local check cashing stores to get money to pay the rent.
Oh, I'll go to the check and cashing system and say, can I have a money order for such amount?
And what did they charge for that?
They charge 1%.
Did you add up those fees as you went along and realize how much you were paying?
Not really, but I...
She got a job recently, and her employer told her about Bank on LA, which matches unbanked clients to special beginner bank accounts.
They are what we call second chance accounts.
Cesar Treyes is a community development officer for Union Bank. He helped place Rodriguez with one of the bank's divisions called Cash and Save that weans people off check cashing services and into mainstream banking.
As you reestablish a relationship and you show a cleaner behavior, you will get a second chance again once you can show that you want to do it right this time.
But of course, the customers are only part of the overall unbanked problem. Sophia Heller heads up economic development in the Los Angeles mayor's office. She says banks need to realize that they're competing with services that are predatory, but the appeal is that they're also easy to use.
One of the advantages of payday lenders, if you ask somebody who uses it, is the transparency there. They walk in, it's like a menu. I cash a check, I pay this. I don't pay in 30 days, I pay this. Banks don't tend to offer that same level of transparency, and that's what they're looking for.
Of course, it's also hard to learn how to use an account when there aren't any banks around. Manuel Pastor is a USC professor who authored a report laying out the case for Bank on LA. He found that lots of banks simply don't think they can make money in these neighborhoods.
There's this whole notion that if there was a penny on the ground, why wouldn't it be picked up, right? But I think that often the banks find it very difficult to visualize a whole bunch of low-income consumers as being a vibrant market, but in fact they can be.
The community of Pacoima, north of Los Angeles, is an example. 6 years ago, a single small bank served a population of more than 60,000 people. Then a Wells Fargo branch opened, and Veronica Padilla of the Icon Community Development Group says it's been a boon for both consumers and the bank.
They're open 7 days a week. They stay open past 6 o'clock. It's in a small shopping center where, you know, the traffic is out of control on Friday evenings with the clientele. So they realize that there is money here.
Wells Fargo declined to comment, but we did talk with one of its newest customers. Julieta Velasco learned about the bank's offerings through a Bank on LA workshop at her daughter's school. Afterwards, she went to Wells Fargo and opened a checking account.
I work a lot with parents, and they trust us, and their fears are not having an ID and not being completely informed. The parents are completely unaware of how much money they can save, as opposed to going to a liquor store and paying a percentage to cash their checks. Using a bank is a way of saving, which most of them do not understand.
Back in Boyle Heights, there is nonstop activity at the Lone Bank of America ATM. Matt Fellows of the Safe Banking Project says it's a scene that's playing out in 60 cities across the country that have bank-on programs. He says consumers are realizing that despite the headlines of the past year, banks are still safer and cheaper than the payday lender down the street. And banks are learning lessons, too.
Just to look at the business that the non-banks are doing in these neighborhoods, they are making about $1.5 billion every year just on check cashing fees. So there's a phenomenal opportunity here.
He says it's about banks getting comfortable serving lower-income communities. But if being warm and fuzzy isn't enough, how about the profit motive? 10% of the population is still unbanked, but that doesn't mean it has no money.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by Thomson Reuters, a source of intelligent information to businesses and professionals around the world. Thomson Reuters, knowledge to act.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Last week, we talked with Harvard Law Professor Elizabeth Warren about the possibility of a new consumer protection agency for financial products. She's the brains behind the proposal and wrote about it a couple of years ago in a magazine. During our interview, she used a metaphor that's become common when talking about the idea.
This is not about limiting consumer choices. This is about making sure that those choices are real. For most of us, that means plain vanilla products.
Plain vanilla. Well, we wondered what exactly that means. So our Amy Scott provided us with this latest installment of the Marketplace Decoder.
We all know what plain vanilla implies.
Boring.
Eric Halperin heads the Washington, D.C. office of the Center for Responsible Lending. It's a nonprofit that fights abusive lending practices. Halperin says when it comes to financial products, boring is good.
The idea behind plain vanilla is we have products in the mortgage, credit card, checking account, other areas, which are straightforward, easy to understand, and have clear benefits for consumers.
Like a nice 30-year mortgage with a fixed interest rate and no hidden fees, a checking account that spells out overdraft charges, or a credit card with clearly defined fees and penalties.
So when we think about vanilla, we think about sort of a base flavor without any complicated things added in.
I hate the term plain vanilla. Vanilla is anything but plain. If anything, vanilla is the most exotic of all flavors.
Tom Erd owns the Spice House, a specialty spice and seasoning shop in Evanston, Illinois.
These big babies are the Tahitian vanilla beans.
Now, Erd tells me that vanilla beans come from orchid blossoms that open for just one day, and there are several varieties, some creamy, some spicy.
Here, if you just smell, see, it's far more fruity. I like to say black cherry.
Just as vanilla is more complex than you might think, there's more to some 30-year fixed mortgages than meets the eye. Some can carry an early repayment penalty, so if you try to refinance, you get smacked with a hefty fee. The Center for Responsible Lending's Eric Halperin says regulators will have to be particular when applying the plain vanilla label.
We have to be very careful to make sure that it's really a straightforward product, and that we don't expand the definition of plain vanilla to include products that are difficult to understand.
But what if you don't want vanilla? Maybe you'd prefer strawberry or chocolate or chubby hubby. Wayne Abernathy is a vice president at the American Bankers Association. He says not every homeowner wants a 30-year fixed mortgage.
My first mortgage was a 5-year ARM. I liked that because interest rates were falling. Had I locked in at a fixed rate, I would have been paying more than what the market was for a long time. And that's the problem when you decide that one size fits all. Usually only the average person fits that size.
The Obama administration says customers will still have choices, but bankers might have to slap warning labels on all but the most basic loans. Borrowers might have to prove they understand the risks. As for what to call the safest products, Tom Erd has a better idea.
I think he should use the term brown paper bag rather than plain vanilla. It's an insult to great flavor.
The Brown Paper Bag Association couldn't be reached for comment. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace Money.
It is summer break for students, but not for student loans. New options are taking effect in July, and your minimum monthly payments could be graded on a curve.
If you have an income of $30,000 and student debt of $30,000, it would cut your payment in half.
Plus, more on the new reasons to buy a new car coming up. And if you have to click off your radio to get a barbecue or to buy some groceries, you can always catch up with Marketplace Money online. Listen at marketplace.org or subscribe to our podcast and take your show with you anywhere. You're listening to Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. And I've got a question for all you car junkies out there. Just how good is that new car smell? Good enough to buy one? Well, now you have another incentive. A new law known as Cash for Clunkers will allow car owners to trade in their gas guzzler. And quicker than you can say Buick Skylark, turn it into $4,500. Lots of details involved here, though. So we took a little road trip to a nearby Ford dealership for a visit with our friend from Edmunds.com. Phil Reed, welcome back to the program. Nice to see you here in Santa Monica.
Good to see you, Tess.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the details of the Cash for Clunkers program that's just been passed by Congress. How do we define a clunker?
A clunker is any car that gets 18 miles per gallon or less and was built after 1984. And the idea is that we're going to take older, polluting cars off the road and replace them with new, cleaner-burning cars.
How does it actually work? Is this something where you will get a check from the government to take to the dealership, or do you walk in and they just lop that right off of the new car value?
First of all, let me tell you, people are so excited about this law. They are thinking of every way to slice and dice this and every possibility of how it could be used. But essentially what it is your car, the dealer gets an electronic transfer of funds that would be credited as a trade-in, as all or part of the trade-in. Because the whole idea of this program is that it inflates the value of vehicles that may only be worth $200, $300, $400 and gives a guaranteed trade-in value of $4,500.
What cars are eligible for purchase under this program?
The way that the law is set up, it has to be 10 miles per gallon improvement to get the $4,500. If it's a lesser improvement, it's a $3,500.
Improvement over the current mileage of your car.
Correct. So in other words, if you go from a car that has 17 miles per gallon and you're able to find a car that improves it by 10 miles per gallon or more, then you get the $4,500 Cash for Clunkers rebate.
And can this be on a new or used car?
No, it's only new cars.
Only new cars.
Right.
Now, there is another incentive out there that's known as the car tax deduction.
Yes.
Can you explain what that is?
Well, when you buy a car, a big part of the purchase is the sales tax. Here in California, the sales tax is 9%, so it's $900 per $10,000 of car that you purchase.
Right.
So in other words, the average car, we'll just say, is $20,000. That would be $1,800 right there in sales tax. So the $1,900 would be tax deductible at the end of the year.
And that's a separate law from
yes,
the
that's separate,
cash
non-exclusive.
For clunkers.
Cash for clunkers can be combined with incentives, but there are no other restrictions with it.
Well, so that's if you've got sales tax in your state. What if, for example, you live in Oregon where there's no sales tax?
Right. Well, the government has decided that there needs to be some sort of incentive for people in those states. And there are a number of states around the country that don't have sales tax. And according to the language of the IRS, it's slightly interpretable, but it's the purchase prices, which often are tied to the sales price because it incentivizes. In other words, the higher the price of the car, the more sales tax, the bigger the deduction.
Okay.
And it would be a similar thing in states that don't have that.
So I guess at some point you have to assume that the dealership is going to help you out with that math and tell you how it's going to work.
People need to understand that it's still really important to negotiate a good deal, to buy the right car, all of those other pieces. What I'm worried about with Cash for Clunkers is people are going to hear about Cash for Clunkers and just race down without doing their homework. And what's going to happen is you still need to negotiate your lowest purchase price and then deduct the Cash for Clunkers. So this doesn't guarantee that you're going to get a great deal.
Does this plan, the Cash for Clunkers plan, make it any better to buy a new car than a used car?
I'm a big fan of used cars, and I think that that's probably a bigger way to save money for a lot of people. It requires more expertise to shop for a used car. It doesn't have the allure and the new car smell and all those other things. And people don't realize that $4,500 is often just the swing, you know, from good to bad in a car deal. So it's not like hitting the lottery or something like that.
Well, what do you think, Phil? I mean, you've been watching the industry for a long time. Is this program going to be effective? Because it certainly sounds like there are a lot of details that you have to figure out before you can do it.
Yes, people are very confused by the bill, but they're also very excited by it. And based on the kind of traffic we're getting at Edmunds.com, we're getting about 16,000 hits per week just on the articles about Cash for Clunkers. People are definitely watching this. They're thinking about it, and I'm sure it's going to have some effect.
Well, with that, Phil Reed of Edmunds.com. He is the Senior Consumer Advice Editor. Thanks so much for meeting us out here on the lot.
Always good to talk to you.
Let's go look at some cars.
All right.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com.
It's time for Getting Personal, the part of the show where we answer your questions about all things personal finance. And I'm joined once again by our economics editor, Chris Farrell. And Chris, we've got Bill on the phone from Washington, D.C. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
So how can we help you out today?
Well, my question is about insurance on rental cars.
Ah, okay.
I recently got rid of my car and the insurance, so now I'm renting. When I go to the airport, I'm faced with this list of options, all in very small print, on what to do for insurance. I'm not sure what options I need and whether or not they're adequate.
Chris, I think many of us tend to think or assume that we're covered by whatever credit card or debit card we use. Is that true?
Well, maybe. I wouldn't make that assumption. Now, there's several layers. Bill's in a different situation because he doesn't have an auto insurance policy anymore. Because the standard advice for most of us is check with your auto insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
If I rent a car, you know, am I covered? And then your credit card offers like a secondary layer of protection. Now, your situation, Bill, is a little bit different. By the way, I think this is a fascinating question because more and more people are doing this.
Getting rid of the car?
Getting rid of the car, getting rid of the insurance, getting rid of the maintenance. I mean, you actually do save a lot of money. So if you're doing it just a couple times a year, I just take the rental insurance. It's annoying because we don't really have to pay for it if we're already covered. But if you're not covered and you're doing it five, six times a year, it doesn't add up to that much money.
I already have, you know, personal health insurance, and I have homeowners insurance, and I have the credit card coverage.
Yeah, I don't think either the health insurance or the home insurance are going to help you out if there's an accident and you are at fault.
Interesting.
But here's what might help you. The policy that is better for most people, if you're doing it 10, 15, 20 times a year, is to get what's called a non-owner's auto liability policy. It's not that expensive. And it's designed for people who don't own a car, but, you know, you borrow your friend's car. And like all insurance, you shop around, talk to the classic insurance companies, auto insurance companies, they all offer it. It's not that expensive, but it does protect you, and that's what I would do.
So there you go. That sounds like a pretty good option.
Very good. I appreciate the help.
All right. Good luck with all of your non-driving.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
Take care.
And Tess, one thing I just want to elaborate on, just in case everyone's wondering about their credit card, because you're absolutely right. We do get a layer of protection with our credit cards, but there's a couple of, what do I say, restrictions. First of all, it has to be personal use, and you have to put the full cost of the rental on the credit card. And the other thing is the terms vary depending on your bank. So
read the fine print, as always.
As always, but this is one of those times, don't assume. Read the fine print. Some of the coverage by some cards is pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
It's not bad at all. It covers us for most situations. Other ones, you know, it's fairly thin because they really don't want to offer it. They don't want the cost of it. So you'd have to find out, okay, if I use this card, what are the terms? Read the fine print.
And you really want to make sure that there is enough there that whatever state you're in, you are allowed to drive. Because, I mean, most states, if not all of them, they require you to hold insurance.
Well, you happen to be in one of the states that requires it,
okay.
California.
All right. Well, okay.
Yep.
So, Bill, if you visit us here in California, be sure to bring your insurance. All right. Next, we have another question involving risk. And this time, Chris, it's all about identity theft.
Oh, you know, I hate that stuff.
Oh, boy, I do, too, having been a three-time victim myself. We are talking this time, though, about kids. Anthony in Palm Beach Gardens, Florida, has a baby who's just about 6 weeks old. Congratulations, Anthony. He got a Social Security number for his son so he could open a 529 college savings account. Now, every 4 months, he and his wife run their credit scores just to make sure that everything is kosher. But he's wondering, now that his son has a Social Security number, does he need to run that one as well?
The answer is yes, he does.
Okay.
You know, part of me feels really sad giving this answer. It bothers me. It troubles me that, you know, you'd have to add this to your list of things to do. But this is the world we live in. And so there has been greater identity theft with these accounts. And then oftentimes it's not discovered until your child's 18 years old and they go to apply for their own credit and they find out, oops. There's another thing that you can do, which would be to put a credit freeze, a security freeze. We've talked about this in the past. You know, just put a freeze on it. Then you don't have to worry about it.
All right, if you have just a tiny baby question or a big whopping ball of confusion, we can help. Give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. You can also send us an email. Just go to the marketplace.org website and find the Getting Personal link there. And we'll be back with more Getting Personal later in the show. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. School is out for summer, but while students are taking a break from studying, many are also continuing to figure out how they'll pay for college. Starting Wednesday, July 1st, they'll find some helpful changes in student loans. I asked Lauren Asher of the Project on Student Debt to start with the specifics on grants.
Well, Pell Grants go mostly to students with family incomes of $50,000 or less, and they can make a huge difference in paying for college. So the new maximum Pell Grant is going to be $5,350, up from $4,731.
Okay, terrific. And now let's get to the loans. First, let's talk about the new income-based repayment plan. This is something that is brand new. Who is eligible and how does it work?
Some people have loans through the government called direct loans, and some have their student loans through private lenders like Sallie Mae. If they're Stafford loans, they're still federal loans and they're eligible for income-based repayment. A good rule of thumb for IBR eligibility is if you owe as much as you earn, you're probably eligible. And a good example is if you have an income of $30,000 and student debt of $30,000, it would cut your payment in half from a standard 10-year payment to an income-based repayment. And after 25 years of income-based repayments, whatever's left, if there is any, including interest, will be forgiven.
Forgiven? Completely just wiped out?
That's right.
All right. Well, if you're not eligible for the income-based repayment plan, let's talk about the interest rates for new subsidized Stafford undergrad loans. These rates have been dropping for a couple of years now. What happens on July 1st? And again, who is eligible?
The College Cost Reduction and Access Act of 2007 started the gradual reduction of interest rates on subsidized Stafford loans from 6.8 to 3.4, but it's happening over several years. This year, the drop is from 6 to 5.6, which is quite substantial.
Okay. And again, these are for loans that have then been borrowed against since that legislation was passed, since 07, right?
Right. This is for new subsidized Stafford loans. So Anyone who's taking out a subsidized Stafford loan for school this fall will have a lower interest rate than they did last year. Another important change is that for people who took out Stafford loans before July 1 of 2006, when interest rates on these loans were variable, we'll see rates drop quite a bit. The new variable interest rate for Stafford loans will be just 2.48%. So if you haven't consolidated your loans already that are variable rate, now would be a great time.
So when you consolidate those loans, does that 2.4% interest rate, is that then fixed for all of your consolidated loans?
Once you consolidate, it is.
Okay. Any changes at all, any of this affect private loans whatsoever?
Income-based repayment is only for federal loans. Any kind of federal loan you took out to pay for your undergraduate or graduate education is eligible, but private loans are not.
What do you hear about progress in the Obama administration's plans to just completely end government subsidies for private student lending?
There are a lot of proposals out there for how to reform the federal loan system to save more taxpayer dollars and use them to help improve student aid. And even lenders have come up with ideas that are different than the current subsidy structure and are suggesting that more savings could be found.
All right. Lauren Asher is Associate Director of the Project on Student Debt in Berkeley, California. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tess.
And one additional change coming to student loans, simplicity. The Department of Education announced this week that it's streamlining the standard application that students fill out to get financial aid, the FAFSA. If you apply online, you'll be able to import your tax information directly from the IRS, and the form itself is getting much, much shorter. This week, U.S. Customs officials revealed they'd seized more than 10,000 pairs of counterfeit Nike sneakers from a shipping container at the port of Los Angeles. The haul was valued around $400,000, but if they'd been the real thing, it would have been more like $2 million. The value of any shoe comes from its designer. On this week's A Day in the Work Life, we click our heels to hear from one of them.
I'm Catherine Kerrigan, and I'm a shoe designer. I'm 6 feet tall, and I wear shoe size 11, and I design women's shoes in sizes 6 to 15. As a teenager, my experience was I visited about 6 regional malls to find one pair of prom shoes that continued into, you know, finding shoes for my first job interview, finding shoes for formal events, and it's always been an issue. In college, I actually studied pre-law and kind of bailed out at the last minute, and I thought, I'll go to business school. And as a final project, I had to put together a business plan based around a niche market. So I thought this was the perfect opportunity to find out why, at 6 feet tall, I cannot find cute shoes for my size 11 feet. I really thought I would just do research and come to some conclusion and get out of business school so I could get on with my life. I interviewed 400 tall women, and I became so passionate about designing shoes. I knew at that point that I had to keep going with it. I had to find out more. I had to just get more involved in the footwear industry. It kind of is a step-by-step process. I sit and sketch a couple times each week, or whenever I'm kind of inspired, or whenever something really kind of comes to me. And I do all the design work, and I go over to our factories in Italy and Spain, and I pick out leathers and materials, and I determine
toe shape. And check out the details. Now this is a beautiful shoe. This is our Josefina booty that we made in a special red shimmery color. It's gorgeous, and it's a must-have.
I can go out and I can design a million pairs of shoes that I love that are totally impractical and that no one will ever purchase. That was really kind of the explanation of my first year in business. I would make all these funky designs that I thought were so different and they're not on the marketplace, and I didn't have any sales. So it's been hard to not dumb them down, but kind of make them more appropriate for the mass market. As a fashion designer and as a shoe designer, industry standard, you'll probably make at least $40,000 to $50,000 per year. What makes me feel good is when we have customers calling us or emailing us saying, Catherine, I'm 50 years old and I wear a size 13 shoe and I've never found cute feminine shoes. And they're kind of on the verge of tears, and it's very emotional for women, because if you don't feel the way you want to feel or dress the way you want to dress, you kind of feel like something's off, and that's what makes me feel good. At the end of the day, it's not money. It's, you know, giving women the opportunity to feel and look good and feel confident.
That was shoe designer Catherine Kerrigan. A Day in the Work Life was reported by Aaron Scott. Most of us are getting fewer, if any, credit card offers in the mail. If you do get one and you mail it back in, prepare for rejection, no matter how awesome a credit user you think you are.
There's a small group that's really super creditworthy, and they'll probably have the most choices, but you've got a vast swath who may be surprised.
That's coming up on Marketplace Money from American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and I am one of those people who looks forward to arriving home and checking to see if there's any mail. You know, in the age of email and e-vites, it just feels so special to actually get an envelope with your name on it that you can see and touch. Except, of course, for envelopes with junk mail in them, like those formerly ubiquitous credit card solicitations. Don't miss those. But apparently, some people do. Here's Marketplace's Rico Galliano.
Now I know what you're thinking. No junk mail is good junk mail. And personally, I agree. On my list of all-time most hated things, I'd place junk mail just below fascism. That's me at my mailbox. And that's me a minute later, shredding the ads, menus, and coupon packets stuffed inside my mailbox.
Stupid Bed Bath & Beyond coupon.
But here's the thing. I thought everyone shared my hatred of this stuff. Not so.
I actually like getting credit card solicitations.
Ladies and gentlemen, Marketplace senior editor Betsy Streisand. And no, she is not clinically insane. Before the credit crunch hit, she shared my disdain for the forest's worth of card offers that packed her mailbox every week. But after the credit crunch hit,
they stopped, and I felt rejected.
Was it rejection or fear that maybe perhaps you were no longer a good credit risk?
It was fear, and it was fear of future rejection. But then one day I came home, and I had a credit card solicitation, and it was like a Sally Field moment.
You like me right now. You like me.
See, for Betsy, getting a card offer in the midst of this credit crisis means she's special. A member of an elite clique of the creditworthy. I decided to research that theory, and it turns out Betsy's right, kind of.
It is absolutely true that we are seeing a significant decline in the credit card solicitations received by U.S. households.
That's Anuj Shahani. He's with Cinnovate, a marketing research firm, and he studies credit card mail data.
The number of households that received a credit card solicitation dropped to 40% or so in the most current quarter as compared to the historic levels of 70%, which we are used to seeing.
So, yes, if you get a card offer today, it means issuers consider you a better risk than over half your fellow countrymen. Maybe. Because remember, just because you get an offer doesn't mean if you apply that you'll actually get the card. And the offers may not be what you're used to.
People are getting solicitations which are slightly more upscale. The offers tend to have higher rewards or better rewards programs, and also that tend to be with a fee.
In other words, forget free cards with low fixed interest rates. Issuers these days want you to pay an annual fee in exchange for, say, airline miles. Why that shift? Nessa Fettis is VP of the American Bankers Association. She chucked it up to the Credit Card Act Congress passed in May.
It restricts the ability to raise interest rates on existing balances. And that means that credit card companies have to use some other model to be able to manage the risks that people aren't going to be able to repay their loans.
The companies would rather charge fees than plan on earning money off interest rates they can't raise. But wait a minute. What if folks like Betsy Streisand don't want a fee-based card? She's part of an elite clique, the mere 40% of households who even get card offers. Doesn't she have the power to ask for whatever card she wants? According to Nessa, not unless Betsy's super special.
There's a small group that's really super creditworthy, and they'll probably have the most choices. But you've got a vast swath of people who may be surprised.
She says a 780 credit score, a great payment history, and a card offer in hand doesn't mean you've got bargaining power. In this economy, companies want more.
They may be looking at assets. I mean, somebody like Warren Buffett, I think we know that he's got assets in case he's not able to repay his credit card.
Does he get a lot of credit card solicitations, do you think?
I have no idea.
I think he's probably got as many credit cards as he needs at this point.
I think he probably does, but you get my drift.
I do, and it's this. If you think you're a big shot because of a Visa offer in your mailbox, well, you might not be as big as you think. In Los Angeles, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace Money.
And for more coverage of our relationship with credit, go to marketplace.org and click on The Borrowers.
Marketplace Money is supported by Thrivent Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thrivent.com. And by saveandinvest.org. Helping military service members and families manage their money with confidence by providing unbiased financial information, tools, and more. online at saveandinvest.org.
We are back with more Getting Personal, and let's get right to the phones. Antoinette is calling from Brooklyn, New York. Hi, Antoinette.
Hi.
So what's your question for us today?
Okay, I recently gave notice at my full-time, well-paying job with benefits.
Oh, my goodness. What, I know. What are you doing? Dropping your job in an economy like this?
I know. I thought about it a long time. I have some other interests that I want to pursue, and it's just a good time in my life to do it. I don't have kids. I don't have a mortgage.
All right.
The budget that I worked out leaves me pretty confident that I have enough savings to last about 6 months. But I have credit card debt that I've made a pretty good dent in paying down over the last year by paying well over the minimum. So my question is, while I'm not working and I don't have money coming in, should I pay the minimum on my credit cards, or should I keep trying to pay more than the minimum?
Interesting question, Chris.
We've
got someone here who's quit her job, but who has, how much credit card debt do you have?
A little more than $10,000.
$10,000. Okay. But she says that she's all set for 6 months without a job. A, is 6 months enough? And B, should she be paying down that credit card debt or saving more money?
Okay. Got all kinds of rations. First of all, Antoinette, congratulations.
Thank you.
I think it is wonderful that you're taking a risk. Look, you got to get on with your life. You want to do something, you got to plan. Now, in terms of the credit card debt, I would say yes. Pay the minimum, but I got a little bit of a twist to this.
Okay.
And I am assuming that you're not adding to your credit card.
No,
correct?
I'm not, and I haven't for more than a year.
Okay. So you make your minimum payment. So let's just say it was $200 or whatever it is. And then over the following months, just keep the payment the same, even though it doesn't add up to much, but it's that habit of being a little more aggressive, you know, not tying up too much money into your paying down your credit cards.
But Chris, if she keeps paying $200 on a $10,000 debt.
Or whatever. I'm just making up a number.
Yeah, but I think that is probably a realistic amount for a minimum payment. I mean, she's just going to keep racking up interest payments.
No. Now, look, we're talking a six-month period of time. This is not a permanent state of affairs. I assume that what you're doing is going to earn you an income, correct, Antoinette?
I'm expecting that I'll have some income coming in, but I made my budget projections based on not having any coming in just in case.
Okay.
But then let me ask Antoinette, what's the plan after 6 months? I mean, are you counting on getting a job if this other side work doesn't work out?
Well, I'm going to be doing two things during the time off. One, doing more of this work and see if it's something that I want to do full time, but also looking for other work full time.
Okay. Take the minimum payment for 6 months. You either figure out you're going to get a new job, and then you're going to start having to devote a lot of that salary toward being more aggressive on your credit card debt, or you'll adjust to a different form of life, and then after 6 months, you're going to realize that you're going to have to make more than the minimum payments.
Okay, great.
All right, thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Okay, next we have an email from Nick in Sterling, Virginia, and he owns a house in Tennessee, but he's having some problems maintaining the mortgage payments. Recently, an investor offered to buy the house by keeping the mortgage in place, but basically taking over the mortgage payments. So Nick is interested in this, but he's never heard of this process before. What do you think?
Okay. My bottom line is going to be no. And just so we're sort of clear about what we're talking about, it's an assumable mortgage, or you assume the mortgage. So, Tess, you own a house and you put 20% down, you've owned it for 5 years, and you have $100,000 left on your mortgage.
Mm-hmm.
I come along and I say, well, Tess, I'll assume the mortgage. So I'll take that $100,000 and I'll just start making those monthly payments. And then just to keep your example simple, I'll pay you something for the equity in your home. The basic problem is most mortgages today are not assumable. The industry moved away from this. So my guess is you can't do it anyway. Point two, are the mortgages that are assumable, the lender will insist on a credit check on this investor. So you got to go through that whole process. Point three, why would you get involved in something like this? It may still be a decent transaction, but, you know, let's keep our financial lives simple. I mean, why complicate them? You're going to need a lawyer, by the way, if you do this kind of transaction.
Okay. And Chris, next we have an email from Nathan in Martinsburg, Pennsylvania. His father has apparently always disapproved of the idea of investing, did not want to open any sort of custodial account for him while he was a kid. But pretty soon he's going to be 18 and he wants to start investing his money in something other than a savings account. So he's going to be going to college in about a year, isn't sure how much of his money should go toward that or perhaps toward longer-term investments. So what does he need to know about the basics here?
Okay, first of all, he's making the biggest investment of his life, going to college. And therefore, you want to at least limit as much as possible the amount of debt that you take out to pay for that college education. Secondly, I know there's this, you know, you're not making much on that savings account, but you do graduate in 4 years. You do want to have some savings. And the thing about these savings accounts, you know, FDIC insured, yeah, you're not making much interest, but the money's there. So I kind of like savings accounts despite everything. Now we're going to get to your real question. He still wants to invest in the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
So my conservative hat says, you know, if you put the money into a broad-based equity index fund, you will be so smart compared to your peers. I mean, so smart. But if you want to have a little more fun, hey, go ahead and buy yourself an individual stock or some individual stocks.
All right. Hope that helps you out, Nathan. And thanks for writing in. Now, that is all the time we've got for this week, but Chris is answering your questions all day long on his Getting Personal blog. That is at our website, marketplace.org. Go ahead and check that out. Or give us a call. We're at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Chris, thanks as always for the great advice.
Thanks a lot.
This is Marketplace Money from American Public Media. Now, of course, we ask you every week to write in with your personal finance questions, but now and again, you do have some thoughts on how we've been covering things. And our producer, Eve Troe, has been sifting through our email inbox. So what's been coming in?
Well, there are three words that really caught my eye. Plastic, cheese, and toilet paper.
Let's start with plastic.
Many, many people wrote in about our interviews with finance guru Dave Ramsey. His mantra is no credit whatsoever.
Right. Credit cards, evil.
Yes. So lots of Ramseyites, I guess that's what we'll call them. Lots of Ramseyites said yay for having him on the show. But this listener, Carla Morelli, said we should have evened out Dave Ramsey's lopsided view.
There's a healthy balance between credit is evil and I live beyond my means. Credit is a tool, not a way of life.
His response is, no, they are not a tool. But point taken, point taken. Shall we get to the cheese?
Sure. Last week, Marketplace senior editor Patty Hirsch, she stopped by to help us understand the new proposed Consumer Financial Protection Agency.
Right. And we did talk about cheese. This was a metaphor that he used for us.
Yes. Well, Kudlai Abiri from Washington, D.C. says cheese is a good comparison, but the agency should be more like a cheese store that lets you taste the cheese.
Okay.
All kinds of financial cheese could be sold, but the banks have to be upfront about what's in them and what they're like, maybe even give you a sample of how they work in real life.
I like samples.
Whole Foods. And Rob Mayer in Cincinnati says an even better comparison than cheese is something I don't think you're going to like.
And what would that be?
Fugu. So this is a pufferfish you can eat as sushi, but if the chef doesn't prepare it correctly, it can kill you.
And the Japanese strictly license the sushi chefs that serve fugu, and I would think we want to regulate similarly toxic financial products.
And anybody who, you know, wants to write in with more analogies, I guess, is welcome to.
Absolutely. Bring them on.
And finally, in honor of Father's Day, we heard from writer Lauren Weber about the financial example her dad set.
He used hand signals out the window of his car to preserve the turning lights. He even tried to ration toilet paper, telling my brother and sister and me how much we could use for each bodily function.
I have to say that sounded a little extreme.
It did. So Alan Specht in Lincoln, Nebraska says that's no way to live. And he wrote this, presenting this individual as a sage icon of money management is a bit like allowing someone to come on and gush about the valuable diet lessons she learned from her anorexic mother.
Yikes. Boy, those extreme metaphors just keep rolling in. Well, Eve, thanks for sifting through them and appreciate you coming in.
Well, you know, I pride myself on never mixing my metaphors.
Yep. All right, folks, you can write to us with your thoughts. Go to our website. It's marketplace.org. Last weekend, more than 100 national parks were free to the public. We talked to rangers at two of them about how they were getting ready for the crowds, so let's check in on how things went. Ranger Dylan Carey is at Crater Lake in Oregon, and Carrie Cobb is at Yosemite. We'll start in Southern Oregon. Dylan, thanks for giving us an update.
Thanks for having me back.
So tell us, how were the crowds last weekend?
We did have a 60% increase from last weekend.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. Is that unusual?
It is a big increase. However, with schools getting out, it's to be expected. And also, it might be even more rare because we did have a snowstorm on Sunday.
A snowstorm?
Yeah, it can snow any month of the year out here at Crater Lake.
Given that this was the first of the three weekends of the summer, anything you learned for the next time around?
Not a lot of people knew about it. I was surprised to hear.
So it must have been a nice surprise to get to the entryway and not have to pay anything then.
Yeah, we have, you know, we have some people who don't realize that there is a fee, and they usually turn around. But, you know, this weekend was different because we could tell them to come on in. It was really fun to be out there and greet visitors. You know, I was being kind of tough with them and giving them trivia questions, saying that you can get into the park for free, you know, if you answer this trivia question about the lake. So,
give me one of those questions. Maybe I can answer it.
How wide across is Crater Lake in its widest spot?
Oh, Lordy, I don't know that one. I should, because I've only been there, you know, five or six times, but I should know this. What's the answer?
It's 6 miles across.
6 miles.
Yeah, it's a big place here.
Wow. All right. Well, good luck on the next one, and thanks so much for talking to us these last couple of weeks.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
So Carrie Cobb in Yosemite, how'd it go over the weekend?
Well, it was very busy, which is what we expected. The traffic was actually not so bad since all the cars were able to just come into the park and there was a nice constant flow. It's been one of the first sunny, warm weekends we've had, so I think the timing was absolutely perfect.
Were you able to get out into the park at all to enjoy it?
I was, yes. I actually went out and went on a few hikes, and there was definitely some extra visitors on the trail, but everyone was happy, and I actually drove a little bit, and I noticed it was very easy to get to one side of the park versus the other just because the flow of traffic was so nice.
You know, you mentioned last time we talked that one of the hopes of the free weekend was that, you know, folks might spend some money elsewhere around in the community around Yosemite. Did you find that visitors did buy more things or go to the restaurants like you hoped?
Yes, yes. Since there were more people, the restaurants were definitely full. Mm-hmm. I went to the store to buy some groceries, and it was a little hard to get around the grocery store. There was a few more people. You didn't want to go around dinner time, which unfortunately I did. It seems like a lot of families came and bought memorabilia and took lots of pictures and just enjoyed everything here.
Well, Carrie, it sounds like a very successful weekend. We really appreciate you talking to us these last couple of weeks, and I understand you're headed out on a hike as we speak. So
I am.
I'll let you go.
Thank you.
Thanks so much for your time.
No problem. Bye.
And that's Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, if you're in marketing and you're out of work, the product to sell is yourself. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Stephen Hoffman and Eve Trobe. Special thanks this week to Pablo Garcia. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer is J.J. Yore. Remember, talk to your own expert before you make any big money decisions. I'm Tess Viglund. We'll see you next week.
Want to hear something from Marketplace Money again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and information on transcripts, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need is only a few clicks away. Just point your browser to marketplace.org. Marketplace Money is supported by Thriven Financial for Lutherans, a not-for-profit financial service provider helping its members take charge of their financial strategies and put today's market on their side. More at thriven.com.
American Public Media.